Welcome on to our continuing season preview series here on the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. This is going to be our maiden voyage for a three-man pod, but this is a team that is so interesting that one guest just was not going to cut it. So joining me to talk about the New York Knicks, Jason Concepcion of Grantland and Jared Dubin. Oh, wow, did I really say Dubin? That's terrible. Jared Dubin, since I've known you for 3 years, that's really terrible that I messed that up, of the Internet, including the Cauldron, Bleacher Report, and CBS. Gentlemen, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man, and don't worry about it. I get Dublin and Durbin all the time.
Durbin, like disgraced Illinois politician
Dick
reference
Durbin.
There.
Dickie Durbin.
Oh, yeah. We're going to be esoteric on this Knicks podcast.
Deep dive into Dickie Durbs.
Yeah, and I also really enjoyed how on the first three-man pod, we had both of you responding at the same time. So we are off to an incredibly auspicious start here. So really, when we're talking about the Knicks, obviously, last season was the worst season in franchise history, right?
Yes.
From both an aesthetic and from a record standpoint. But the good news is, at least, a lot of those people aren't here anymore.
That's exactly the case. I was looking over your outline that you sent about stuff we might talk about, and it's basically like, well, half the stuff doesn't really pertain because those guys, you know, everyone was a placeholder and they're all gone, for the most part gone, and they were just real, real, real bad.
I was actually talking to Chris Herring at the preseason game last night, and we realized that only 3 guys that are on the team this year were in training camp with the team last year. It's Carmelo, Jose Calderon, and Langston Galloway. Everybody else was either acquired during the season last year, like Lance Thomas and Lou Amundsen, or is completely new this year.
Well, so no Knicks podcast, obviously, would be complete without some amount of belly aching from the guys who follow the team. It, just walk me through, Jason, your emotions last year as you're following this team, because what I was thinking was, yeah, this is losing, it's miserable, but getting a high draft pick in the 1 year they actually happen to have their pick is actually about the most fortuitous thing that could have happened in this franchise long term.
Yes, that's exactly the case, which is what's kind of it's kind of annoying about like coverage locally. Is everyone understands or understood at the time that the Knicks are tanking. They need the draft pick. This is how you get – this is their best chance to get better in a hurry, in a sustainable way. And yet really the only way to cover that locally from, like, the papers is this is a disgrace. I mean, everybody knew what was going on. They had to be bad. And in that sense, even though it was the worst – season in history from a record standpoint, it was not even the most painful season for this fan, like as in terms of just emotional torment.
Can we get an emotional torment Knicks season power ranking out of the past like 10 years?
It's real. I mean, it would be like all the Isaiah years, like the top would be the top 3.
Yeah, I think like, the year when they made the Jamal Crawford and Eddie Curry trades, I mean, did you realize when those were happening that, like, oh, these are awful trades, or was there actually, like, some hope that those could work out at the time?
I mean, it just looked, you know, it's like, who are you bidding against? The guy, like, the first reaction is this guy going to drop dead, like, on the court? You know, like, is Eddie Curry's heart?
Yeah, that's right, because he was only available because they had that thing with the Bulls where he wouldn't submit to, like, the heart, like, DNA testing or whatever,
like,
it was.
Is this guy going to die?
I think even worse than those two trades was the Steve Francis trade.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. That
was just, yeah, like...
That was bad.
Because, I remember
they're going to recreate Dumars and Isaiah with Stephon Marbury and Steve Francis.
That was such a disaster.
But Larry Brown year is probably the absolute lowest because, you know, there was some thought, hey, Larry Brown, play the right way. Maybe you can turn around. And it just turned into like recriminations and the coach and Marbury feuding in like amazing ways. And there was like cryptic comments made like on the team plane about, I'm going to snitch on Isaiah because he did this from Marbury. It was just like bad. It was bad.
Was that the same year that the sexual harassment scandal broke? Like, did that happen towards the end of that season, or was it after that?
I believe it was towards the end of that season.
Yeah, and that was also the year that the Bulls had their pick straight up, so they gave up the number two pick that year. And then obviously the pick swap the year afterward, too, that enabled the Bulls to get Noah. But so, Jared, obviously, painful year last year. They then screw up the tank job in the end of the year, don't get into the top three. They end up getting Kristaps Porzingis. Overall, you know, I mean, I think we can assume they wouldn't have gotten the number one pick anyway, but is Porzingis the type of guy that, was it worth all this to get him?
See, for me, and I said this after the draft, you don't, the framing of, you know, we tanked to get this one guy, I think is a bit flawed.
So let me stop you right there. I mean, we've talked about tanking. How badly was the tank? How intentional was it? It seemed like at least at the start of the year, they had designs on contending, but at some point it switched to tanking pretty early on when it was clear that they weren't going to be competing.
Right. I think it sort of started in earnest, after game two, I guess, even though they wound up winning a
That's
game.
Right, they beat Cleveland in the opener,
right?
Right,
they beat Cleveland in the second game of the year in Cleveland in, like, the Cavs' home opener. But Melo,
oh, yeah, that's right, because they got waxed by the Bulls in that first
right.
game. That's
right, but Melo, like, very clearly injured his knee in that game and was just very obviously not moving around well after that, and that sort of, you know, made the Knicks very obviously worse on the court. And then once it was clear they weren't going to be any good at all, they just they steered into the skid, I guess you would call it, and, you know, tore the whole roster down. It wasn't, you know, like the fire sale that it was framed as in some of the papers out here, because the guys they were trading weren't exactly, you know, game changers.
Yeah, I thought that was a good trade, the Smith trade and Shumpert trade. A lot of people killed it, but because they turned the Cavs around. But Shumpert, I mean, did they want to be paying him 4 for $40 this year? And Smith would have actually been an albatross salary probably for them. He would have opted in if he had stayed all year.
Right. The way that's been framed also, I think, is a little misleading, where it's like, oh, you gave up J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert for whatever it is, a 2019 second-round pick. But I think, you know, the better framing is really that you gave up Shumpert for, you know, two back-end-of-the-rotation players, a second-round pick, and the right to not pay J.R. Smith $7 million for the 2015-16 season. And I think that, you know, if he had been in New York over the last 3 months of the year, he wouldn't have been playing really well for a good team, so he wouldn't have opted out of his contract. He would have stayed in. So I think it's another case where the framing is a little bit off.
Yeah, I've made the argument that basically they almost got a first-round pick worth of value from Shumpert, because at the time Smith was basically dead salary, and, you know, it was about, he had about $10 million left on his contract. And the going rate had kind of been $10 million in dead salary for a first-round pick. That's going up a little bit now with the cap going up. But, yeah, I thought it was actually a totally fine move to get that type of value out of a guy in Shumpert who wasn't in their long-term plans anyway. But back to Porzingis, Jason, you and I were there at Summer League. You saw him in person. Then how good is this guy going to be? Is he the savior? Is he going to be a nice player? And how soon might those come to reality?
It's really hard to say. I think the thing that really jumped out at me from Summer League was, I figured he'd make an impact, if at all, this season on the offensive end, and he'd have to figure it out on defense, and that turned out to be completely flipped. In that he's a pretty solid defensive player, moves his feet well, understands how to use his length, doesn't back, like he got, in summer league, he just got bullied by Okafor when they played the Sixers. But he never stopped competing against it, and then he switched it up in the second half, started fronting. He just doesn't stop competing, and he's going to be a solid, surprisingly solid defensive player. Is he the savior? I don't know. I mean, when you look at the talent that he has, you can understand why you would take him that high. Just the skill for the size, mobility, he can shoot the ball. Obviously, he weighs about 150 pounds and looks like, you know, four drinking straws, but you know, that's to be, he's 20 years old now. So, it's very, very promising. Knicks fans are super excited about him, and everything I don't know whether this is just, he's well drilled by his team or what, but he just, has managed to say all the right things so far.
Yeah. I thought his agents, at ASM Sports, did a great job of kind of getting him ready, trying to position him as different from some of the notorious Euro busts of years past. Jared, where do you come down on his potential? Do you think he could be a superstar someday? Is he more top out as kind of a solid second or third option, or do you think he has bust potential?
Well, I think that a lot of it depends on the way you frame it. You know, there's a guy's ceiling, there's his floor, and then there's the most likely case. I think if you're taking a look at his ceiling, it's rather easy to see why there were some people who said he's got a chance to be the best player in the draft eventually. Like, if you take a look at what his skill set actually is now, and like Jason said, the way he's more advanced defensively than maybe some people thought, you know, and if you project improvement and physical maturity onto that, it's easy to see where those people thought, you know, this is a 7-plus-foot big man who looks like he's going to be a plus shooter from range, who moves very well, who has ridiculously long arms and moves his feet well defensively. And you can see why people thought that he had a shot to be the best player in the draft. But then if you look at his floor, you know, he's a 7-foot rail thin big man who, you know, for now offensively mostly seems to get his scoring from, you know, someone else creating for him, whether it's a catch and shoot jumper or finding him on cuts or in transition or things like that. And if you can't necessarily create anything for yourself and you're dependent on teammates, if you don't have someone who can set you up, then there's always the potential for you to be, you know, too passive to be an impact player. But, you know, if you look at, you know, what's like his most likely case scenario, which is probably him developing into, you know, an above average NBA player. Even if he were to hit that, and it would be somewhat disappointing, he'd still be, you know, the best Knicks draft pick in like 20 years or so. They've signed, I think, one player to a second contract longer than 1 year since I was born.
Yeah.
So
not a good.
If he just hits. Yeah, even if he hits like an average career path for a player drafted as high as he is, and doesn't become like a franchise-changing superstar, he would be, you know, the most satisfying Knicks pick maybe since Patrick Ewing.
I want to take a quick break here to tell you about our sponsor, DraftKings.com. DraftKings, the second sponsor, and it's really a great way to make football a lot more interesting on a week-to-week basis. It's fantastic. Way better than FanDuel, by the way, since FanDuel has kickers and DraftKings doesn't. Obviously, you know that there's really no way to predict kicker performance, so it's a lot easier to have those not in there. All my friends use DraftKings instead of FanDuel for that reason. Hopefully, you will do the same. So DraftKings, you can do it every week. Millions of dollars in prizes available. Every play matters. You know, even blowouts are fun to watch. Great way to watch Red Zone every week. And hurry to DraftKings.com right now to sign up. You can use the promo code CAPSPACE, all one word, and that lets you play for free with your first deposit in this Sunday's $1 million fantasy football contest. So that's CAPSPACE, DraftKings.com. Thank you very much. Wow, that, you know, when you put it like that, that's that's pretty remarkable. So I'm going to be a little redundant here. I've kind of delivered these opinions on past podcasts, but for Knicks fans who might be listening for the first time, I think Porzingis can be a very solid player. I respectfully disagree a little bit with Jason about his mobility. I think it's decent for the five, but that at the four, he might be a little slower than would be ideal. And he's not, from putting the ball on the floor standpoint, I think he's like pretty glacial. You know, he's not going to be able to drive past a closeout to get all the way to the rim without the help getting there first. And I think he's been really effective in the preseason, faking and then stepping in for a two-point jumper. So I think that's going to be useful. I ultimately think his best position is going to be center once he can put on a little more weight. Then the fact that he's an awesome shooter, which he already is looking like in the preseason, you stretch the defense out from the center position. I think at power forward, you have a lot of guys now who are used to getting all the way out to the three-point line. And if you put a guy who's like a stretch four, or even if the other team decides to go small, I think they have the advantage on him at that position. But at the five, if he can hold up defensively, then he looks a lot better. And I also don't think he's going to be a guy you go to one-on-one in the post. I'm not sure that he has that type of move, but I think as a pick and pop, and then also a pick and roll guy too, with that, with his good length, he can be effective there, sucking the defense in for alley-oops. I really like him. So I don't think he has superstar potential. I think he can be a guy who really opens things up for others with his shooting, and then can hold up defensively and be a very effective player. That's kind of how I see him.
I have no qualms with that at all. He's shown a couple of nice show-and-go moves. I think finishing pick-and-pop is going to be his bread and butter, I think, for the coming season and the next few seasons offensively. He's, like, going to the rim, he's just not strong enough and not really coordinated enough to finish in that way. He's going to be a jump shooter offensively.
Yeah, and that's another concern, is that in watching his film from Spain, he didn't look like he had a ton of feel. I think he's getting better as a passer. The fact that the triangle has him handling the ball more and getting some reps with that, I think, is good. You talked about using him in pick and pop a lot. Is there really, if they do keep running the triangle, and how much they are running is another question, but is he going to get three-pointers out of pick and pop in that offense? Because that's really what can make him effective ultimately, I think.
Yeah, last year, they, towards the end of the season, even more so, it wasn't so much that they broke the offense, but you know, they went to sort of the backside pick and roll a little bit more often towards the end of the season. And then, you know, on the front side, when there was nothing there, they defaulted into pick and roll stuff a little bit more often. So they did it more than you might imagine from a team that, you know, runs pure triangle stuff that doesn't run it all that much. The issue for me with him getting in pick and pops a lot is that there's really only one good pick and roll passer on the team, it looks like, right now. Just because Jose Calderon doesn't provide all that much of a threat when coming up.
I think there's only one good passer on the team, period, right now, right?
Right. I think it's basically just Jaren Grant. And right now, Grant is coming off the bench and Porzingis is playing with the starters, so it's unknown how much those two guys will play together. And it's just not that much of a threat for Calderon coming around a screen right now, because guys can just play right up on him and take away the jump shot and not worry about him blowing by. So you don't necessarily have to send two guys towards him, which would free up Porzingis for a jumper. If he plays a lot more with Grant or maybe even Galloway, who's not necessarily a threat to shoot, but he's very quick, so you might have to get someone to stand in his lane for a beat more. But you know, if Porzingis spends most of his time playing with, you know, the slowest guys on the team in Calderon and Aflalo, and even Melo, who's very deliberate in the way he operates, then there won't be that many opportunities for him to take pick-and-pop threes.
Well, let's get into a little bit more of this year now. To me, the number one question going into the year is how Carmelo Anthony is going to respond. He had this knee debridement, basically it seemed like missed about 6 months of basketball activities. Granted, he was able to play on it throughout half of the year last year, even if in a somewhat limited state. So you hope that it wasn't that much damage that had to be repaired. But we've seen guys like Danny Granger, a perfect example, who really have not been the same after this. How's he looking so far in the preseason? What are the reports like? What do you expect out of him this year?
He's looked amazing. He's just been splashing jumpers, making quick moves. He looks on the, I think he said something like, he put some kind of percentage on his rehab, but he's looked really good. It is a worry. I mean, he's 31 now. I'm honestly more concerned. I'm less concerned about his physical, the physical toll than how he mentally puts up with, kind of the rockiness of a team that has, you know, a 7'3" rookie that's 20 years old, that's going to play perhaps like a large role and a lot of new players. You know, he's made, you know, there were rumors that he was unhappy with the pick before, and now he's saying all the right things. But at the same time, I think everybody is kind of like wait and see with how Melo handles what's sure to be a sub 500 team. That's really what interests me.
Well, so sure to be a sub 500 team. Probably, you think that is certain in your mind?
I think they'll probably be a sub 500 team, but an improved team, obviously, from, you know, below 20 wins. But I think, you know, new team, a lot of rookies, weird old guys in the backcourt. They'll be better. They may challenge for 500, but I just don't see them getting there.
Yep. Yeah. What about you, Jerry? You feel that way?
I think that, you know, the most likely result has them finishing below 500. Is it possible that they finish over? I guess, but they'd have to be, I think, the most improved or the second most improved, because Milwaukee did it last year. They'd have to be among the two or three most improved teams that finished with between 14 and 20 wins the year before in order to just get to 500. I looked it up last year. There were 55 teams in the modern era that finished between 14 and 20 wins, and I think six finished over 500 the next year. So you're talking about a massive, massive amount of improvement. Obviously, Carmelo playing and being healthy will help. How much, I'm not sure. They were still really bad when he played last season. It's a lot of new guys, which should help, you would think, just because there's actual NBA talent here this year, which is more than you can say for a lot of the guys on last year's team. But you're still asking them, I mean, they'd have to improve by 24 games just to get to 500. It's so much. You know.
Yeah, and you can argue that maybe there doesn't, we shouldn't be trying to translate from last year to this year, because as you mentioned, a lot of those guys just aren't around anymore. And they did get a lot of signings to get in some competent NBA players. Derek Williams is not fantastic as a starting four, but at least I think belongs in the NBA. He's had an okay preseason. Robin Lopez, totally average starting center, getting Carmelo back. Hopefully he'll be better this year, especially defensively. Aflalo, you know, I think people kind of wax and wane on him a little bit, but ultimately, when you look at it, to me, you've really only got two above-average players on this team. I would look at everyone else as below average for their position. That's Lopez and Carmelo.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they've picked up some solid vets, but you know, these guys haven't played together before. Calderon and Vujicic, when they've shared the backcourt together, have just looked like a sieve.
That's just a ridiculous signing to me. I mean, the guy washed out of the NBA 4 years ago, and he might be starting for this team.
His hair trigger has not dulled in his time in Europe.
He took 13 shots last night.
He will shoot the ball. I will tell you this. The machine will shoot the ball. It's amazing.
Another reason that I'm kind of down on this team, and you guys follow it more closely than I do, but I think that kind of low-key, they might have a really bad training staff and, like, sports science. What do you think of that?
Historically, I agree with you 100%. That being said, they hired Joshua Langstaff, who's, like, the young former video coordinator and player personnel person from OKC. That's a positive step. They've talked about taking that more seriously in some of the interviews that Phil and Steve Mills have done. So it remains to be seen. I agree that historically their player development has not been good.
When did he come in? He came in last year?
Last year, yeah.
Yeah. And I will say this. This is maybe more of a skill development than a health thing, but I was very impressed with kind of their pregame routine when they were out here in Golden State. And I think they did adopt a lot of that from Oklahoma City with the young guys and the skill development. Not that there is a crap load of young talent on this team. I mean, I guess you could look at Grant as someone who perhaps isn't getting enough pub. But, yeah, I do think that that's pretty good. But there always seem to be guys with nagging injuries. And just now in the preseason, you've got Aflalo out with a hamstring. Calderon always seems to have some sort of a muscle injury. And last year was no exception. Porzingis has struggled already with, I think he had a hip issue during summer league and then now a thigh issue. I forget who else is kind of in the rotation who's out. Kevin Serafin. Yeah, who they signed. So there always seem to be little knickknacks and guys missing time. That's another reason, in my opinion, to be a little pessimistic about this team.
Yeah, historically that's 100% been the case with this team. You know, guys, some of that is just like the players they get are always over the hill, et cetera. But like I said, you hope that like with the signing of Longstaff and hopefully whatever else is going on behind the scenes that slowly turns around. But that has been the case, and it is always a worry.
Is an improvement over Roger Hines slapping a headband on everything.
Roger Hines putting ice in a rubber glove. Like, just bad.
Or taking care of, you know, a gash on Jason Kidd's head by slapping a headband on it. But the way Fisher was talking about various injuries when I was at the game yesterday, he did mention some stuff about how they're doing more personalized training regimens for guys this year and how they have to adjust based on, you know, players' fatigue levels or where they're at in their respective injury processes rather than, you know, just having everybody do the same thing. And even in terms of managing guys' practice loads based on whether they're a young guy like Porzingis or Grant or older guys like Carmelo and even Sasha Vujicic. So I do think that they're doing a little bit more stuff that's more in line with where the league is going, at least based on those early conversations.
Well, all right. This is a team that, oddly enough, didn't get a lot of attention last year other than just, hey, they're really bad. Who, and you can include the free agent signings in this too, who is kind of better on this team than people kind of realize nationally?
I think Kylo Quinn, just because people don't really know who he is. He's not anything incredible, but he's kind of utilitarian bench player that does enough of everything to kind of bolster a second unit. And he's going to be a fan favorite in New York just for how hard he, you know, it's like, you understand, like watching the Knicks over the past, you know, X amount of years, just seeing a guy who plays like super hard is a plus. And he plays hard and he's pretty good. And nobody really knows who he is, and his contract is I think it was 4 years, 16. If he keeps producing in the way he has been in the preseason or somewhere around there, it's pretty good.
Yeah, Jared, what's his game like for people who don't know?
Yeah, I would say he's just like Jason said, he's just solid at, you know, pretty much all big man skills. You know, there's nothing he does that jumps out immediately as like, wow, he's really good at X, but he doesn't seem to be particularly bad at anything either. He's a serviceable shooter. He's a serviceable post-up guy. He's a serviceable rebounder, and he plays really hard. And, you know, when you look at the guys they had last year, they were all very bad at least something. You know, like Jason Smith was very bad at defense. Andrea Bargnani was very bad at everything. Samuel D'Alembert was very bad at staying awake in team meetings. O'Quinn doesn't seem to be bad at anything, which is, you know, really kind of what you want from a bench player if they're not going to be exceptionally great at any one skill. And that does seem to be where he sort of fits in right now, especially with the second unit where he's playing right now with Grant and Galloway and Derek Williams, who are probably the three best athletes on the team. Maybe you want to include Thanasis too, but he's not really playing. So having someone that's more just a solid guy that knows what he's doing out there with those three, I think has worked pretty well for them so far.
What about someone who might be overrated on this squad?
Aflalo?
Yeah. That's where I'd go to. People think that he's still like a considerably above average defender because that's what he was in Denver. I guess people didn't watch that much of him as he took on a bigger offensive load.
And even in Denver, the advanced numbers didn't like him that much. He was just sort of the guy on the wing who's kind of muscular and quick, so people just assume, and they put him on the good guys, but numbers-wise, he never really worked out, and I think he's declined since then, as you mentioned.
He's also,
part of his reputation is kind of like a statement about the weak state of the two-guard as well, you know? So, like, it carries over. It's like...
Yeah, Simmons had that column like three years
Dwayne
ago.
Dwayne Wade and Aflalo and who else? Nobody. So, I think he's got some bust-ish potential.
Yeah, that's not to say that he's not an improvement on what they had last year.
Oh,
I mean, I think a walking duck would be an improvement on what they had last year. But he does have a player option for next season, which could wind up, you know, if he plays like he did, you know, last year, that could wind up being a thing that bites them next summer as they try to carve out cap space.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've only got about $17 million right now with those player options. Aflalo is $8 million. Derek Williams, I think, is about $4.5 million. If they want to get up to a max slot, they got to hope either those guys don't opt in or that you're going to have to dump some salary.
Supposedly, when I was at Summer League, I heard from people who know that supposedly Derek Williams said when he had the meeting with Phil, he was like, you're going to have to pay me. Like, he was basically saying, I'm going to wow you so much that, you know, you're going to have to fork up the money at that.
Was this right as he was watching YouTube videos about how to learn the triangle offense?
I guess. Supposedly that's what he said. So,
he's really motivated this year.
So we'll see. He would have to play, like, he would have to be a solid contributor for, like, the entire year before I would ever trust him. He's like, I mean, he's played really well. Well, I mean, he's...
In two preseason games against all bench guys.
He's not... He's looked... as lost as ever on defense, but his shot, because he's been cutting really well and he's been dunking, he's been active on the offensive end at least. Even when he's bad defensively, he's actively bad.
I can't decide whether actively bad or passively.
Well, no,
bad.
He's not bad in the way that he seems to turn off. Like, he looks like he's really trying to do something. It's just like he runs really hard in the wrong direction. But so that said, like, it'll be, he's a guy that's like, I don't trust, but it's interesting to see if he actually comes through.
Yeah. I think Aflalo is a great choice for someone who might potentially be overrated.
I've got a,
did you even consider saying Carmelo in response to that question? Either of you?
No, come on. I mean, like, he gets a lot of crap, but he's a good basketball player. He's just,
There's a segment of the population that overrates him, and there's another segment that underrates him just as much. So I think that, you know, the general opinion of him that he's a very good player, but not quite in line with the rest of the, you know, truly elite best players in the league, I think that's right on. That's just sort of the area that he lies right now. The other guy I was considering saying was Calderon. He's as bad on defense as ever, and, you know, the fact that he can't necessarily move around even as well as he did early in his career, which was not all that well to begin with, takes away a little bit from the threat of how good of a shooter he is. I think it's interesting that I don't know where his offensive contribution comes from besides just the fact that you have to guard him because he can't do much off the dribble right now.
Yeah, I mean, he can kind of set up nice passes for guys coming off screens, but I agree with you. And Carmelo, that 12-13 and 13-14 seasons for him were awesome. And you look at the fact that he always plays, it seems like, on a good offense until very recently last year, and a lot of times hasn't had that much offensive talent around him. Even in the days when he wasn't that efficient, his team always was pretty good. So I think he, in some respects, would get a bad rap. Well, let's talk about now who they have on this team. What do you see as kind of the playing time position battles that Coach Derek Fisher is going to have to work out for this team?
I think
the most obvious one to me is the backcourt. I think it's been fairly obvious through the first couple preseason games that Grant looks like their best player in the backcourt.
What's he been doing?
He is just, every time he comes in, he changes the whole pace of the game. Even Carmelo mentioned it in his post-game interview after the game against the Sixers last night, that he was talking to a Aflalo on the bench about how they want to play with him. About how Carmelo and Aflalo want to play more with Grant because of the way he affects the pace of the game and gets guys involved. He's delivering like these one-hand no-look passes. Jason pointed out on Twitter that he's making, you know, the type of athletic plays that Knicks point guards haven't been able to make in, you know, God knows how long.
In ever.
Yeah, he has really good size. He's very quick, and he's a really, not just a good passer, he's sort of an instinctive passer where he's throwing guys open. You know, they're not necessarily open at the time he delivers the pass, but because of where it's placed, they wind up open at the moment they catch it. That's something that, you know, jumped out on the film of him at Notre Dame a little bit, but you didn't know that it would necessarily still work within the Knicks offense because it's so much different than what he played in at Notre Dame, which is one of those sort of spread them out, free-flowing kind of offenses. So to see that it's still happening, at least early on, you know, through summer league and the first couple preseason games, I think is a really positive development. And then he just looks, you know, the combination of him and Galloway so far has just looked so much better than, you know, the two starting guards, which is Calderon and Sasha Vujicic for some reason.
Aflalo's been
right.
out. Obviously.
Fisher did say that he's kept it that way because Aflalo is going to slide into that spot instead. So we'll see if that changes things. But I do think it presents, you know, an interesting dynamic because those two guys are, you know, so much more, and I don't like to use the same word again, but they're so much more dynamic than the two guys that look likely to start. So it'll be interesting to see, I think, if they push to be elevated.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's and that's the point of, if there's going to be a kind of like a non-mellow point of locker room canceritis, it will be there because, you know, is Calderon going to be a jerk about losing time to a rookie? Fisher is already committed to starting Aflalo. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Lanx, Galloway, and Grant together have just been able to cause a level of chaos that you're just not used to seeing as a Knicks fan, like, ever. You know, when you look at the history of the Knicks, Grant is, I think, probably the best athlete they've ever had, ever. I mean, you'd have to go back and say, like, Nate Robinson, you know, but he's 5'9", you know what I mean?
I would say Marbury. He was a pretty amazing athlete back in that time, but that's at least, I mean, with his quickness and strength, I mean, but he didn't do anything defensively.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's kind of what you're pointing
out.
Well,
just like the ability to wow you with like a fast break and above the rim play. Marbury was,
yeah,
was still plenty athletic, but he wasn't that, he was more of a physical beast in that he could just take all kinds of contact going to the rim. I mean, he was like one of the first guys I ever remember doing that cradle, kind of running back cradle the ball thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're just not used to seeing that kind of athleticism from a Knicks backcourt that's had, you know, like Charlie Ward and even Mark Jackson, who was great, but was always slow. And so that's exciting. And yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah. What about power four? That's another one that's kind of a good playing time battle for this team, or maybe not a good playing time battle, but a playing time battle.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you could make a case for, I think, four different guys to start a power forward. Melo is very obviously the best power forward on the team. He does not like playing there, no matter how many times he says publicly, like, I don't mind it. Like, you know, he complained about getting bodied by David West. He didn't like guarding KG. You know, he doesn't like it. And, you know, whatever, what are you going to do? And they've been very vocal about, you know, thinking that he's a three. Offense.
Yeah, well, they also have no threes on the roster. Yeah.
Offensively, it doesn't much matter. He's going to play how he plays. And some of the power forwards are a little bit stretchier, so you can make the argument that it sort of inverts their positions offensively and defensively. Defensively, Melo guarding on the perimeter is, you know, not great. Chris Herring has pointed out multiple times, I think, that he allowed, you know, in the top five worst guys in terms of three-point percentage when he was the guy guarding the three-point shooter. You know, his sort of lateral mobility defensively has always not been quite where it is on offense. You know, that's the case for a lot of guys. He happens to be one of them, I think. He actually has done a very good job defending the post in his career when called upon to do that. And when asked to move in short spaces, he's a little bit quicker than when he is in open space defensively. So putting him at the four works much better there. But to circle back around to the original point, you know, Melo, then, you know, Porzingis could start at the four, O'Quinn could start at the four, Derek Williams could start at the four. There are a lot of different guys you can use there. You can even use Lance Thomas there. There's only 96.
I actually saw him take a three in one of the preseason games. That was remarkable. But yeah, so who do you think should start out of those guys?
It's going to be I think it ends up being, man, I don't even know.
Well, and there's a dual question, right? There's what'll make him best this year, but then also Porzingis, it's kind of better if he develops to get more minutes. And also, I think just the perception that he is developing is going to be really important. Hey, we have this guy starting for what you're trying to get free agents. You want to position this team as kind of an up-and-comer.
They've been giving him about 20 minutes a game starting first and third quarters before they go to O'Quinn and Serafin and Lance Thomas. So I think that probably remains the case. He's got, as the, you know, the top draft pick, he's got the best claim to it. I don't know if that necessarily translates to the best basketball in terms of wins and losses this year. But it's an interesting battle, you know, just from a philosophical standpoint. I think I would expect that either he starts right away or they go with like O'Quinn or something and then they bring him in after like five games and say, okay, now Porzingis is going to start for the most part.
You don't think it'll be Derek Williams? That's in my, like, you know, 3,000 miles away reading of the tea leaves. I sort of thought that it might be him.
Yeah, I thought that at first too. Obviously they came out with Porzingis the first few games in the preseason. And last night they went small against Philly with Lance Thomas. I think with Porzingis, the question is affected by who starts in the backcourt. Because I think with the way his skill set is right now, and Nate, you mentioned this earlier, you don't necessarily want to have to count on him to create his own looks. So I think that him playing either with Melo or Grant is pretty much a necessity. Grant because he's the best passer on the team, and then Melo because he just draws so much attention that by itself would open up opportunities for Porzingis. So I think that if he doesn't start, then, you know, keeping Grant on the bench so that Porzingis plays a lot of minutes with him would be sort of a necessity. If Grant does start, then both Melo and Grant are in the starting lineup, and I think you should want to get Porzingis in there too. You know, to me, it matters less whether he starts the games than that he's put in a position to succeed. You know, when he's out there, you want to have other guys out there with him that augment his skill set and help make him better and put him in position not only to do the things that he's good at, but to cover up the things that he's not quite as good at. And I think that offensively, Melo and Grant are the two guys most well-suited to do that.
What's your guys' crunch time lineup for this team?
Yeah.
What's the best five they can put out there trying to win a game down the stretch?
This is a tough question. My guess is Galloway, Grant, Melo, some combination of power forwards and Lopez. Obviously,
so is that your guess at what they will do, or like your own personal opinion what they
should
do?
My personal opinion of what they should do based on what I've seen just right now.
Yeah, it sounds like both you guys think Grant is going to be better than Calderon this year, and that's I haven't seen enough of him to say, but usually you worry about rookies' defense, but there's no way his defense is going to be worse than Calderon.
Almost impossible, unless he actually died on the court and they just left him out there.
Or if he was in a body swap comedy with Ray Felton.
It's not going to happen.
Well, actually, that still wouldn't be worse than Calderon's defense. Like, that's the one guy that is worse than Felton defensively.
Yeah, he just can't move. He just has no movement.
He's not one of those guys that doesn't try defensively. He just can't move in the right way to be able to control all these guys that are so quick.
Yeah, so who's your four in that crunch time lineup then?
I think it's sort of the same question where, you know, you can use a bunch of different guys. You know, it could be Melo and you have a Flau out there too. It could be Porzingis some games. It could be Williams. It could be O'Quinn. I would imagine that Fisher will sort of feel it out and he won't necessarily have one closing lineup just because, you know, there are so many different options that you have and none of them yet are necessarily definitively better than the others. If somebody separates themselves and becomes a guy that you just can't keep off the floor, then great. That would work. That would be exceptional. And I think that honestly might be the case in the backcourt too. You know, I would imagine that Fisher would feel more comfortable with Calderon closing a bunch of games than, you know, maybe either Grant or Galloway on occasion, especially early in the season, just because he knows what he's getting from Calderon in terms of, you know, getting them into their offense, running things, making smart passes, being a really good shooter. You know, and if you have Galloway out there with him at least, who's probably, you know, the strongest defender in the backcourt, it looks like, then you can sort of hide him on whoever the weaker backcourt option is.
Yeah, I think maybe what it would be for me, assuming that Grant is kind of what you guys think that he can be, and Galloway is not a guy with a great pedigree. Maybe he regresses this year after getting into like playing for a real NBA team instead of being the one guy with a pulse last year. But I like that defensive backcourt. And then maybe with Aflalo at the three and Carmelo at the four and then Lopez, that might be a way that they would want to go as well against certain teams, especially if they don't have, you know, like a Chris Bosh type of post-up threat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Melo and Lopez are probably the only sure things to be closing every game. You know,
I bet you a Flau will be too. There's no way that they. I mean, I think with them having signed him and his starting track record and nobody else in the roster, whether he deserves it or not, I feel like he's going to be out there.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
We learned a lot from the first. I mean, the Knicks' first six games are brutal. So we're learning a lot in the first part of the season that maybe we don't, as Knicks fans, may not want to learn. I think it's like Bucks, Hawks, Cavs, Wiz, Spurs, and Bucks again. So in some order like that. So it's going to be a tough opening of the season.
Yeah, I mean, the first three home games are against Atlanta, San Antonio, and Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And in there, I can't remember who else the road games are against. But it's a tough test right away, for sure.
What do you see as the main strengths of this team? What are they going to do well?
Long twos from the elbow, mid-range shot from the elbow. I don't even know.
Carmelo might be the best long two shooter in the league, which is we deride because it's not necessarily efficient, but there is value in always being able to get a shot. I mean, he lit up the Wizards on some really tough long twos. I am a little worried. You know, people are saying, all right, for sure, he's back. I want to see him be at least shooting efficient shots. You know, it's not sustainable to be efficient just draining every long two that you take. So I want to see him back out at the three-point line more, getting to the foul line more before I'm going to say, yeah, he's back from the injury. But, you know, obviously his performance so far has been encouraging. What else besides long twos? And obviously the triangle gets you a lot of long twos also.
I think that the two that stand out to me are they have two of the best post-up wings in the league with Melo and Aflalo. Like, Aflalo, even while he's not played as well the last couple years, his post-up game has been very efficient, you know, even in comparison with the rest of the league, not just in terms of other wings. You know, last year he was one of the most efficient post players in the league. He might have even been pretty close to number one in terms of a certain number of attempts. So those two guys and the triangle creates a lot of post-up opportunities for wing players. So they sort of fit in well in that sense. And then the athleticism of the second unit, I think, is something that jumps out. Grant Galloway and Williams are the three best athletes on the team. And it's not that often that you have three guys that come in and, I mean, it's tough to draw conclusions from preseason, but they've changed the pace of the game every time they've come on the floor so far in the first few games of the preseason. And based on the fact they're doing it, not necessarily with skill, but just with the fact that they're really fast and really athletic and excel when they do push the pace like that, I think that that's something that looks like it could translate just in terms of giving an energy boost. So those would be the two things I think that they're sort of the best at.
All right, if you're an opposing coach, then what's the weakness? Where are you attacking this team?
It's kind of lineup dependent, but I think you'd want to, you know, you want to put them in a lot of pick and rolls and just make them make decisions on the defense.
Just run any NBA offense you want.
Yeah,
that's
been the case over the last several seasons. They're giving up a lot of looks from three. They did that last year, and so that's a concern. And I, you know, teams that are very good at moving the ball and getting high quality three-point looks will feast on this team right now, I think.
For sure.
Would you say coaching is a weakness for this team?
I don't think I know that much about Fisher.
I will freely admit I didn't watch that many Knicks games. People have been killing Derek Fisher. Is that warranted?
I mean, he was not – he. It's hard, it's so hard to say because they weren't supposed to be good last year. You know, so it's like you look at little anecdotal things, which would be like – he never seemed to be running his team during blowouts, you know, like it would be a lot of players bickering and then him standing there. He seems to be better. I mean, it just in terms of what he's saying, he's got a more cohesive vision for what he wants the team to be. It's incomplete. I don't think there's any way you could, you know, it's tough to judge last year and it's, you know, this year hasn't started. So it remains to be seen whether he is a coach.
Fisher, I don't think we know much about him as a coach yet. That wasn't a real team he was coaching last year. You know, situationally, I think he left some stuff to be desired last season. But, you know, again, it's tough to know because they weren't a real team. But it was certainly concerning that I think they had, like, a bunch of shot clock violations out of timeouts last year. If I'm remembering correctly, they were not good defending out of timeouts either, which is sort of an obvious place where a coach can make an impact simply because it's the first play after he's talking to the team. You know, lineup-wise, last year there were some hiccups, I thought, but again, it wasn't a real team. So it's tough to say
until they're
real guys.
And they're theoretically developing guys / tanking, whatever you want to decide that it is. Now, what are the key questions for this team that you feel like are going to kind of make or break their season? If it goes well, they could get to the higher part of their range. If it doesn't go well, we're looking at the lower part, other than obviously catastrophic injuries.
A lot of it's chemistry, you know, wise. Can these guys who have mostly not played together gel? Do the young guys, do Grant and Porzingis, develop in a way that they're contributing something positive to the team and not really hurting the team, not being overly rookie-ish, which is like a stretch, I think. How does Melo handle, like I said before, how does Melo handle the team probably not making the playoffs? I think those are, you know, those are going to be things that there's a lot of question marks around the team just because of the mix of young guys and, you know, weird, somewhat weird old guys. So I think a lot of it comes down to just how does Melo handle this team missing the playoffs again?
If you were management, would you be looking for a trade for him? I know he has the no trade clause, but if you were running the Knicks, would you say, hey, we got to get something for this guy now? Or do you hold on to him, try to see if you can make that free agent splash in 2016, and then if you don't, then maybe you move on from him next year?
I think that's the, I think see if you can make the splash is probably the safest, because if you, obviously you can't do anything without him knowing, and it would just poison everything, I think. It would just overly poison the atmosphere if you were overtly being seen to try and move him right now. Unless he, that's what he really wanted, and that's like a whole other kind of poison. So I think it's most likely you do the second thing. That's what I would do anyway.
Yeah, I'm with you on both of those answers. You know, in terms of a big question, I think it's got to be the defense. This team that's had one good defense since Jeff Van Gundy left, basically. You know, with I think like two exceptions in the last 30 years, every team that's won a championship, although, like, obviously this team is nowhere close to that, but all of them except for I think two or three has had a top 10 defense. They've been nowhere close. They don't necessarily have that many above average defenders on the team, but if they can become merely a below average defense instead of, you know, one of the worst two or three defenses in the league, that helps a lot. You know, there's a big difference between being below average and being incompetent. And that alone can help win an extra, you know, four or five games or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what you've talked about, some of the variability in the rotations, I think that what Fisher can get out of some of these guys, he has a lot of guys who have one or two discernible skills, but maybe not the all-around game that you would like. Calderon is a really good shooter from three, great kind of standstill passer, doesn't do much else. Derek Williams can shoot the ball from outside, get out in transition, finish cuts nicely at the rim, not really much of a one-on-one score, not much of a history as a defender. Porzingis, we talked about what his strengths and weaknesses are. Galloway is kind of an energy guy, maybe just a developing offensive player. Aflalo can be good at times, good in the post. You know, do you make him, you want to make him shoot more threes instead of long twos? There are a lot of guys who can do some things on the court. It's just what you have them doing from a role perspective, who they're paired with. I think that's going to go a long way towards determining what these guys can do this year.
Yeah, and they're trying to do something, you know, they're trying to play a double game in a sense, in that they're trying to develop young guys while also bringing in veterans who will ostensibly make the team competitive, and that's not an easy thing to do. Especially for a team that doesn't really have a great history of developing young players and with a rookie coach and, you know, a somewhat neophyte front office. So there's a lot of challenges in that sense.
Yeah, they're, you know, probably the least patient organization in sports. I don't think that that's out of line to say, you know, based on their history. So I think that combination of having, you know, a few, like, 30-plus guys and like, 28, 29-year-olds like Lopez, and then, like, three or four, you know, really young guys that they want to be key players, if not necessarily this year, then over the next few, the way Fisher balances that is a pretty big question too, like you guys said.
What's your prediction now for the Knicks this year? Give me a predicted record and then a best case scenario and a worst case scenario, you know, other than Melo blows out his knee or something like that.
I think I'm going to be kind and say maybe something around 37 games-ish.
So six yeah. games over their Vegas over.
Yeah, I think if everything turns right, I think that's their – that could happen. I think probably
– so is that your best case or is that your –
37 wins and something happens in the bottom half of the playoffs that causes them to maybe challenge in a three-way race. I think probably like, you know, 33-ish wins, something in there.
Yeah, and how about – what about the worst case?
Oh, man, I mean, can you even put a number on the worst case? They won 7 games last year.
I mean, assuming Melo's healthy for the whole year.
Worst, you know, high 20s.
Yeah.
Probably is that's where you'd say, well, this is a disappointment.
Are you in line with that, Jared?
I think those are basically the three, you know, 37 and then 33 for the best case, and my prediction were the exact numbers that I had in my head, too. And then, you know, worst case, you know, 22 to 25 wins. Like, I don't think that they're going to get worse barring Melo, being out the whole year again. Asking for 500, I think is asking too much. Best case, you know, they're in the mid to high 30s and in contention for a playoff spot over the last few weeks of the year with other, you know, teams that aren't actually good, but because the East is terrible, are also in contention for a playoff spot. Most likely pace, I think they're, you know, 4 or 5 games back of that group.
So you're thinking kind of 33, 34 wins for your most likely prediction.
30 to 33-ish. And that's a lot of improvement. It's almost doubling your win total from last season. With a lot of new guys, a lot of young guys, and, you know, still clearly, I think, moving in a better direction.
Well, I am sorry, but you inveterate Knicks optimists are way ahead of my prediction for them. I actually thought that they were one of my best bets when I did the over-under podcast for the under, and my reason being, I don't know that Melo is going to be back yet. The preseason's been a little bit encouraging on that score, but just even the fact that he's 31, not to mention coming off knee surgery. I don't trust the health on this team very much. I think that they could start giving a lot of developmental minutes to the rookies. And then just the lack of even average NBA players on this team. There are 2 average NBA players, I think, on this team when you slot them into the role that they are supposed to be playing. So I do think if everything goes right, I could see them 35, 36, like y'all said. There's... especially if the rookies can develop, if Grant can kind of be what you're thinking that he might be. I will admit to kind of having discounted that, and maybe that's my mistake for lack of familiarity. We'll see with him. And Porzingis, I think, is someone who's going to get taken advantage of a lot if he gets major minutes, especially at the 4 this year. So not to say that he won't necessarily show promise. Let me ask you guys this, though. You're both... huge Knicks historians, but just since Phil Jackson took over, how would you grade the team's management, ownership, / front office? So that's, I guess this is from, what, March of 2014?
I guess like a C.
Below average?
Yeah, but considerably better than it's been in the past, so it's like, it's like, it's impossible.
It depends if we're grading on a scale compared to the rest of the NBA or a scale compared to Knicks regimes of the past.
Right. Knicks regimes
of the past.
A scale
compared to the rest of the NBA, it's like a D. A scale compared...
Well, so why is that? Can we... I actually think maybe people have been a little harsh on this team. I mean, like, what individual moves have they done that you disagree with?
I disagree slightly with Jared. I would give them like a C-ish, not even a plus, because I think some of the moves, like, I disagree with Jared, but I'll let him make his case.
It's less individual moves than just the philosophy behind some of them, I guess.
you know, they're very committed to the triangle, and they're not all that concerned with other teams shooting threes against them.
Yeah, that's a big concern.
And, you know, there are things that come up in the philosophy behind the moves, less than the actual moves. Like, you know, some of the signings they made, I think had the right idea behind them. Like, Robin Lopez is a good idea. Kyle Quinn is a good idea. I like the two draft picks they made this season. But the organizational philosophy in terms of, you know, what they're doing with their offense and the things they care about stopping defensively and the kind of shots they figure to generate offensively, the ideas behind them aren't quite as good as, you know, the execution of what they've done so far. So it's more process over results, you know, even though the results, obviously, in terms of wins and losses, have been terrible. So for me, it's there. But in terms of their performance against past Knicks regimes, you know, at least they have a clear philosophy, which is, you know, is significantly more than you could say for like any, you know, anybody that's been in management since like James Dolan took over. So, you know, on that front, they're, you know, significantly better than what we've been used to in the past.
All right, so you're higher on them, Jason, than
I'm slightly higher. I agree with everything you said. I just frame it slightly differently. I mean, I agree that they're, you know, the triangle, they're moving away from the triangle, which is a positive in terms of like unshackling themselves from just kind of robotically running triangle sets, like right off the bat, whereas they're trying to push the ball, get something quick, get a good look, and then they'll run a quick couple of things, you know, on the weak side usually. So that's something that came out of last year that shows that the team has some kind of capacity to go, oh, this sucks, let's not do that. Last year, Fisher had, I'm paraphrasing, but the quote was basically that they wanted teams to shoot threes, which is like, you know, so you would hope that they would recognize that that is awful and change that. And I think, you know, there's certain teams are still getting a lot of open threes, but it seems like it's not like they're baiting them to take them, at least in the preseason right now. So I guess I'm more slightly optimistic than Jared in that I think that, yes, they have really bad ideas, but I think that they have the capacity to recognize that the ideas are bad in much the same way that they went away from the triangle and seem to be continuing to move away from it, at least as the primary diet of their offense.
I like some of the things that they've done in isolation. I think that, and maybe even from a philosophy standpoint, not so much strategically, or I guess maybe tactically, but more strategically in terms of the long-term vision. I think the fact that they moved on from Smith and Shumpert was very well done last year and increased their draft pick odds. Although they didn't complete the job, I guess, when they were tanking. I think not kowtowing to Melo or those who thought they had to improve immediately and taking more of a guy with long-term upside in Porzingis, that at least concept was good. But I think that there are two things that are really going to haunt them. One is not getting Steve Kerr as the coach. And you never know if you hear Steve tell it, you know, he was sort of waffling and wasn't sure, and then the Warriors came in, and that was his dream job. To hear other people tell it, Steve wanted to make some changes in the organization and wanted to have power if he came in. James Dolan wasn't willing to do that. He wasn't willing to pay him as much. They ended up with Derek Fisher. Steve Kerr, obviously, I think, is, you know, a top five coach in the league, even after his first year. And having seen him up close in Golden State, I think that Emmanuel Mudiay is going to be a lot better than Porzingis, and they're going to regret passing on him. Although Mudiay isn't a great fit in the triangle, and that goes into what Jared was saying about maybe being a little bit too rigid with that. And then, you know, like it or not, it doesn't look like this was unexpected in retrospect, but they had high hopes going into this offseason, and they weren't able to get any real star players who are going to move the needle for this team necessarily. Now, nobody's wanted to go there And I totally understand why. They were terrible last year. But that's still a disappointment, I think, towards what a lot of people expected.
I think that, you know, the expectations of signing a star were sort of always unrealistic. You know, that doesn't make it less disappointing that they didn't do it, because, you know, when you're the Knicks and when you're in New York, you...
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not going to kill them anyway. Too hard for that.
I do think that, you know, and I wrote this before free agency happened, that because it was unrealistic to expect to get any of those star guys, that they should rather, you know, concentrate on signing the type of guys that when you are able to sign a star, have the complementary skill sets that you need around them, rather than signing someone who's not a star to be a star. That's why I thought that the idea of going after Greg Monroe was not necessarily a good idea, and why Robin Lopez was the guy that I said would have been my number one target before free agency. Once, like, Wes Matthews got hurt, and then Danny Green and Chris Middleton were taken off the board, I said that Lopez was the guy that I would go after over anybody else, because when you do get a star, you need someone who's going to be like a junk man, who's going to set picks, who's going to crash the offensive glass, who is just, you know, solid and capable and doesn't need the ball. You know, if you had gone after, you know, sub-stars and cast them in star roles instead, you wouldn't have the necessary skill sets to surround whoever that second star after Melo is, you know, whether he comes next year or whether Porzingis turns into that guy or somebody else does. You need the complementary skill sets, and it's better to have locked them in at the cheaper rate that you could have gotten them at this summer than when they're going to be getting paid like $20 million a year over the next few.
You know what I was thinking about just now? And they signed, let's go through their summer, right? They signed Afolo for $8 million, Derek Williams for $4.5 million, and then I think they signed Lopez for starting at like $12 million, and Okwin was $4 million. What I probably would have done, rather than do that, is just thrown a max contract at Danny Green and signed Lopez. I think that actually would have been a much better use of their resources. And then you don't have this player option issue next year either. Because failing that, maybe I would have said to Aaron Afolo, how about we sign you to a 1-year, $11 million deal with no player option, instead of the 2 years, $16 million with the player option, so then you know that you're not going to get screwed over for next year's free agency. What do you guys think of those ideas?
I think I floated the Danny Green and Robin Lopez idea on Seth Partnow's podcast the night before free agency. Danny Green is, you know, one of those guys who I've been higher on than most people since basically he came into.
I mean, that's an overpay for him. I realize that, but you're overpaying everybody. Yeah. At least you're getting a guy who's good.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was a big UNC fan growing up, and that team was like my favorite ever. That team with Danny Green and those guys. So I did float that. I think it was just sort of not out there. It seems like he just took the deal from San Antonio for less money because that was where he wanted to be. You know, if it was an option to have gotten him, that would be great.
Was really an option.
That's like kind of like I would go back to the thing, to what you were saying about the team kind of ruining not getting Kerr. And while I agree with Kerr is a top coach in the league, et cetera, et cetera. You hear that stuff like he wanted control, this and that. I think that's par for the course for anybody who's coming into the Knicks will ask for something like that. I think I really don't believe that they ever really had a shot at Steve Kerr when you look at the deficit in talent between the two teams, and two, just the fact that he lives there, his daughter goes to Cal, it's like...
Well, but he was talking to the Knicks for like 2 weeks before the Warriors even became an issue. Like, what if they had just bowled him over and locked him up before the Warriors even was an option?
Yeah, I don't think it was ever going to happen, honestly.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
It would have been nice.
I wouldn't argue.
Yeah, and you know, I will say this, right? Like, now we know that Steve Kerr is unbelievable, but I don't know that you could say, oh, for sure, Steve Kerr is going to be better than Derek Fisher. It's two guys that don't have coaching experience who just have the advantage of coming out of the Phil Jackson tree. I mean, Kerr obviously had his experience as a GM, which matters a lot, and I think in retrospect he's much better, but it wasn't, you couldn't tell me for sure that Kerr was going to be better than Derek Fisher this time last year.
Right, and I think the other thing that the difference between those two guys, the thing that's most worrying, like when I think about Fisher, is just the fact that he never got to pick his own assistants. You know what I mean? Like the first season, Kerr went out and he just got great guys, you know, Ron Allison.
Yeah.
You know, and while Fisher pretty much just trotted out, like, you know, the triangle retreads, handpicked by Phil, it seems. So, I mean, that's a concern when you look at the deficit between those two guys. You know, how much of an original thinker is Fisher in terms of what he wants to do?
What do you all think about my point on the Porzingis-Moutier thing?
Moutier's looked really good. He looked great at Summer League. He's looked really good in preseason. I agree, and that's one of those things where quote-unquote, not right for the triangle is one of those things where it just hangs over the deal. But, I mean, that's the price you pay when you get a guy who, like Phil Jackson, who has the stature to make James Dolan go away. And that's really what it comes down to. It's like, you know, who has the juice to make James Dolan not get involved in day-to-day deals? That's the price you pay. I think Moutier is going to fit, too.
Well, so before we go here, I want to just open it up to you guys a little bit. Is there anything about this Knicks season or just what's been going on recently with the team that you guys wanted to touch on? I guess we never talked about that whole Matt Barnes, Derek Fisher thing. But aside from that, anything else that you kind of think is important that we didn't get a chance to get to? Let's start with Jared.
Yeah, I think, and I keep citing him, but I'm pretty sure this is something Chris Herring brought up too. The Knicks were last in the league in drives per game last year. They almost never got to the basket. You know, and that was, you know, when Phil made his infamous goink tweet, you know, the follow-up to it was that basketball is about penetration. So I think it's interesting that they've, you know, built a team where there's really, you know, maybe two or three guys that can get to the basket at all off the dribble. You know, and that's such a good way, arguably the best way, to create quality shots is by penetrating to get into the paint, drawing the defense, or getting to the basket yourself, but they don't really have many guys that can do it. You know, whether somebody unexpectedly is able to do that, or, you know, if Carmelo just starts bowling guys over like he did, you know, more often than early in his career. You know, I think that's something to watch because it's something that now is an espoused philosophy of the team's, you know, the franchise steward. And the team that he's built doesn't seem to reflect that all that much. So I think it's just something interesting to look out for.
What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I would say, for me, the story is all going to be told in how many three pointers this team gives up to other teams, what percentage and how many, and how often they get to the line and run. Those are the three places where, if they improve those things just a little bit because they were so bad, they can get, you know, they can get markedly better. Not better to the point of being good, but they can really show improvement. I think you'd hope to see them focus on those things.
You got time to talk a little bit of Game of Thrones, by the
sure.
way, before
That's
we
what
go.
What do you want to talk about?
when is the sixth book coming out? Do we know yet?
My prediction, and this is knowing nothing, but I think that Martin gets it together enough to deliver a book either right before the next season or right around the beginning of the next season. I think he gets it out before then.
So do we even have any idea how far along he is? I feel like, 2 months before the next season would be the ideal time because to me, it's much better to have the spoilers in the book first than on the show. Just from a business perspective, you're going to get more people to buy the book that way if the show hasn't gone past the book.
In terms of how long he's been writing the book for, freaking, it's, what is it, like 5-6 years now since the last one? And a lot of the stuff in it is like 10 years old. So it's hard, you know, like, where is he in it? It's hard to say. And plus, you know, books 4 and 5 were originally one book. And then he cut off, he cut off a lot of the ending of book 5, and he shunted it over to the upcoming book 6. So he already had a lot of material. It's really hard to say. Like, I think people always say, "Oh, he should be writing." I think when it really comes down to it, he just doesn't really know how to end the thing.
Was any of the stuff from last season? I know supposedly they went off script from the books in the last season. Is that stuff supposed to be winding up in the next book?
I think there's going to be a lot of
completely divergent from it at all.
I mean, it was very, very markedly different, but I think that there's a lot of things in there that will show up in the 6th book in terms of deaths, etc. But they just kind of like cut out the middleman and just went straight to this character dies. So I think that there's going to be a lot of people that died last season that will end up dying either in the next book or the book after.
You're right. I agree with you that I think he has no idea how to end it, because it really seems like if you're going to predict, all right, this is going to be the overall ending of this, right? You'd think, okay, Daenerys at some point has to come in contact with all the other characters. There's got to be some sort of a resolution now with like winter actually coming. You have to deal with all the White Walkers. All of those things have to come together. And it feels like we're still like not even close to that point. And this is a series that ostensibly is going to have 7 books, and he's, you know, 5/7 done with it.
Yeah,
already.
I think when you look at it in terms of how do all those characters meet in the right place at the right time? I mean, she still has to like build boats and a fleet, you know, like, and get.
Based on where she is on the show,
she's not even in Marine anymore either.
Right, so. She still has to get back to Marine before she even comes like to King's Landing.
Yeah, it's gonna be. I think, I just don't think he knows really how to. I think he knows like, okay, I want this to be the end state, but I don't necessarily know that he knows all the details. And you're talking about a book with like dozens of characters. And he has to know where they all end up at a particular point in time. I think it's really, really hard. I think, barring any kind of like end of life stuff, if he were to finish it, I think it's more than 7. I think you're talking about like 8 to 9 books probably.
He's in like his late 60s right now.
Right? Mid to late 60s, and he's a little bit overweight. But you know, it's like. I hate when people bring it up. It has happened. Like, you know, Robert Jordan, the Wheel of Time guy, died.
I'm actually reading that right now. I'm getting to the book where everyone says it's terrible. So I may just skip that one and then get to the one that, like, was it his son who's writing it?
No, it was a fan.
And those books are supposedly awesome again. So.
And it was a similar thing where I think, you know, like, you just at a certain point, writing is really hard, and you just don't know how to really end it in a way that, and especially today, where
you should just do podcasts,
right?
No, seriously, you look at my output lately of podcasts compared to writing.
Writing is hard.
That's all you need to prove that.
And then, I think also when you look at kind of like in the culture's like awareness of like of blowing the ending. And how stigmatized like a creator can become, like if you mess up the ending, and I think that's also in his mind to an extent.
All right, well, this is it's probably enough on dorky fantasy. But since you write such an awesome column on Grantland for that, I figured we'd at least pick your brain a little bit. There's got to be some crossover or another. Jared, we got anything to plug?
I got some stuff coming out for The Cauldron.
Where we now write together, by the way.
Yes. And you had something today that I have as the next thing I'm going to read as soon as we get off this podcast.
That's true. I should plug that. That's the 4 players I'm looking forward to watching the most this year, and then also just some notes on some of the preseason games I've been watching, as well a few more little predictions. But anyway, this is your plug. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no worries. I have something that's going to run, will probably get me murdered by someone because it's about Kobe Bryant. and just the way it's basically impossible to talk about him with pretty much anyone. I got some stuff coming up at Bleacher Report as well, something about Porzingis and something about the Knicks defense, which I guess is topical for this podcast. I have my regular stuff at CBS as well. I do a lot of NFL things there, and I may or may not be doing some basketball things too.
Awesome. And your Twitter handle?
Is at JADubin5. I do also, if I may, want to drop the Harvard Paroxysm season preview will be coming out in the next few days. Written, lots of artwork, the usual stuff that we do every year. Plus, we're going to have a division preview podcast for every division and a predictions podcast as well.
Yeah, and that's obviously Nylon Calculus, which I also write for as part of that network. And I think Nylon Calculus is going to have a feature on a lot of those.
Yeah, they have a section about every team.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome, too. Jason, plugs.
Various things coming out at Grantland, which is a website that is still in existence.
Oh, man.
Yes, it is.
They still have good writers.
Load of traffic, yeah. And it's actually still really, really good, despite Bill Simmons' departure. But, yeah, so... What are you writing about there?
Let's see. I've got a thing about catching people up on the various relevant feuds in the NBA. I've got a thing where I reviewed a book called Erratic Fire, where these two writers took this sounds really lame, but it is actually like really cool, where they took athlete interviews and then they restructured the interviews into kind of like poetry prose. That sounds terrible, but it was really interesting. And then just like the same, you know, stuff on the pop culture side for Thrones, et cetera.
All right, man. And also your Twitter handle, Network, with a 3 instead of an O, probably the funniest regular NBA tweeter as well. So definitely worth a follow there if by some chance you aren't following him already. All right. So thanks so much to Jared and Jason for coming on. This is a great podcast. Get some awesome Knicks knowledge from them. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Nate Duncan NBA. Also, my Facebook page is Nate Duncan NBA as well. That's a great way to keep up with all my writing, both at Nylon Calculus and The Cauldron, as we talked about. Supporting the podcast, the cap space code on both DraftKings and on SeatGeek. SeatGeek especially useful with the NBA season coming up. And also, that's it. Because I am awesome at outros. So we will talk to y'all. Listen to all the other season preview podcasts too. All right, we will talk to y'all next time.